Hello, Bill.
Hello, Matt. Good morning.
Good morning, America. Welcome to the DMZ, everyone.
We need a good morning DMZ thing, Good morning
That's
DMZ.
right.
It just rolls off the
I
tongue.
once met Adrian Cro over the phone. I met Adrian Cronauer.
Really?
He lives or lived here in close by DC in Northern Virginia and was active in the Virginia Republican Party. Of course, I'm talking about the Adrian Cronauer, who was portrayed by Robin Williams in the 1980s Good Morning Vietnam film. I have to say that because I've recently learned that the young millennials have no friggin' idea what I'm talking about, like 98% of the time. Did you read this thing I wrote about it, Bill?
I saw some of your tweets about it. I guess you made an 80s reference in the Daily Caller's Morning Bro online TV show, and it went over their
Well, this
heads.
happens all the time. This is the latest example forced me to.
How obscure was your reference? I mean, let's be fair here. How deep were
All
you
right,
going?
I'll say it to you and you tell me if you get it. So, we're talking
Okay.
about Kathleen Sebelius. This is on our morning show, Morning Bro. And one of my colleagues said, will she be like the fall guy? Will she be the fall gal? To which I said, well, she could always go and do a TV show with Lee Majors next. But I'm bump expecting, look, I don't expect, a fall out of your seat laugh, but maybe a chuckle, maybe an acknowledgement. Instead, it's crickets. And literally, one of my colleagues turns to me and says, we don't know what you're talking about.
I feel like, a friend of mine on Facebook recently made an Eric Estrada chips
The
reference,
best.
and a younger friend said, I just don't know what you're talking about.
Well,
I think
Google
those
it, people.
cop shows,
Google it.
those cop shows, well, of course, but those shows have not kind of stayed in circulation anyway. They don't get replayed on cable TV the way The Breakfast Club
It's
does,
no, let me.
or Heather's.
I agree with you, not like movies, but that's no excuse. Beretta was before my time, but I'm vaguely familiar with the show. Dragnet was before my time, but I've at least heard of it, right? And so I think that the problem is they make us.
But Dragnet was re when we were kids, they used to rerun Dragnet.
They damn right they did. It was part of our education, and they actually did a.
And they made and they, and, they, and that was also an 80s movie with Tom Hanks, so it's an 80s
And Dan
reference now. It's not even a
Aykroyd,
50s reference.
and a cameo from the old guy from MASH, who I think was on the original series. But look, the point here is that it's not my, it's their responsibility to know this stuff. And it's not just cop shows. So a couple summers ago, Barack Obama is, sort of taking a jab at Mitt Romney, and he says, I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. Of course, I walk out of my office going, here we are, face to face. And everybody in my office thinks I'm insane. And I say, the TV show Silver Spoon.
The office?
I did this in my
Is
office.
your whole office a bunch of 22 year
Their
olds?
average, these kids were born in like 1983 or later. I mean, so I walk, maybe like some of them like 1990 probably. It's really weird, but it doesn't matter. I mean, like, this is a show that had Ricky Schroeder, Jason Bateman, the kid who went on to be Carlton, I think, on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Alfonso Ribeiro.
And this little kid, Ricky Schroeder, had a freaking Atari, like, game, not like a little Atari game, but like one of the if you'd actually go to an arcade, he had one of these arcade games in his living room. He had a phone that had a freaking duck on it. How do you forget that? This show is a classic, and I just feel like, number one, I'm sick of me being the comedic fall guy here, and I'm sick of these kids not knowing. I think you owe it to yourself to learn about history and popular culture. And I'm sick of feeling like my jokes are going over like a Led Zeppelin, which they probably don't know what that is either.
Well, in defense of the millennial generation, and in defense of 80s culture, I have to say that I'm surprised that as much 80s culture has actually lasted in the cultural fabric. I mean, there are. I mean, the fact that they had not another teen movie, which had all these 80 callbacks, that kids actually got the jokes from, that Molly Ringwald comes back in the last scene, and everyone understands what that's referring to. That's a lot more than I was expecting, you know, in 1991.
Totally disagree. Look, it's not like I'm making a Cats and Jammer Kids reference or something. I mean, this is 20 years ago. How can, you know, it's not that long ago. I mean, some of this stuff, some of this stuff, you know, creeps into the 90s, into the early 90s as well. I don't know what the deal is, but it's.
Well, wait, I think what the stuff that survives in our memories is this, generally speaking, the stuff that has the most cultural relevance, and I think there actually were a lot of. I mean, it's mostly true with the teen movies, because I would think that. There were some more overarching truths that were not specific to that time period.
You're thinking like the sort of John Hughes sort of stuff.
John Hughes is obviously the biggest canon, but it's also Heathers. It's also Ferris Bueller. Oh, no, that's John Hughes.
All right, well, speaking of Heathers, Heather Locklear, I think. I mean, have you seen the opening to The Fall Guy? This, do yourself a favor, kids. Just Google the Fall Guy opening theme. It is better than anything on TV today.
No Miami Vice.
It's better than that, I would argue. It's
I totally disagree.
And here's the premise that people don't even know. So Lee Majors, also known as the $6 Million Man, is by day a stuntman in Hollywood. And Marquis Post from Night Court is, I think, his agent or something. It's a hit all around. He's a stuntman during day. At night, he's a bounty hunter. Beat that. There's no show on TV that comes close to that. And you can have your Heathers and you can have your Molly Ringwald. But culturally speaking, this Fall Guy, I think, deserves to stick around. And you know, it hasn't.
Well, this actually dovetails into a other piece you wrote. It was for The Week, correct? About how conservatives have turned on Hollywood?
Yes, it was for The Week. This is...
And, you know, some people might see the headline saying, well, haven't conservatives hated Hollywood for a long time? But that's not really true. Obviously, Reagan came from Hollywood. He was the greatest conservative icon ever. And he came of an age when there was a lot of patriotic films in the World War II era that he was a part of. And... as you mentioned, in the 80s, there were a lot of very patriotic films, Red Dawn, Schwarzenegger, Rambo type stuff, and you think something's different now, that kind of filmmaking has been lost, and that is bad.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to overdo it. I mean, at the same time that these sort of like conservative, Dirty Harry, Rambo movies were out, there was a ton of other movies that were, you know, countercultural and projected liberal values. But these were the big budget action movies, and there was a large strain of sort of conservatism, and to one degree or another, that was being expressed. And I think there was a silent majority out there of Americans who were not happy with the malaise of the 1970s and the way things were going, who at least had a home in Hollywood by watching Charles Bronson take on the street gang thugs, you know, turn Bernie Getz, you know, and Clint Eastwood take on not just the rapists and the murderers, but also the bleeding heart liberal district attorneys and politicians who had these silly technicalities. You know, we call it the Bill of Rights, whatever you want to call it. And then Sylvester Stallone fighting, you know, his surrogate war against the Soviet Union and the jungles of Vietnam and other places. And I can't tell you how many people of my age, Gen X conservatives, became conservatives because of the movie Red Dawn, which, of course, the remake was butchered because of the reason that I'm about to tell you. So my point is that these movies...
But your point that a lot of Gen X people came conservative because of Red Dawn, it explains a lot, I have to say. that's a revelatory statement.
I'm just saying it's true, man. That they tell me that they saw that movie and it changed their life. I would argue Michael J. You know, Alex P. Keaton was more of an influence on me. But
that's why you're a rhino, because you know Alex P. Keaton had a soft center. You know, he would turn liberal at the, you know, under pressure.
What a good show! There's another good '80s show. Just great lines. And the dad on that show, I think his name was Michael Gross. He sort of evolved. In the beginning, he was clean shaven and a little bit tougher. And he sort of was like Homer Simpson, where over the course of the years, he got dumber and dumber and funnier and funnier. And he grew a beard. And so that's sort of the dividing line. When Mr. Keaton grew the beard, he really became sort of a caricature. But Michael J. Fox, you know, Alex P. Keaton, his parents had been hippies, and he was the conservative son, sort of the opposite of like an All in the Family thing. They wanted to cast him as Archie Bunker, but he became cool and popular, maybe because he was young and handsome. But I remember there was an episode where Michael J. Fox is dating this chick who is for the ERA, Equal Rights Amendment. And he goes to his dad to get advice, and his dad's like, "Yes, I once spent a summer stuffing envelopes for Richard Nixon because of this young Republican girl that I was in love with." So these shows, even at the time, Hollywood, you know, in the 80s, conservatives hated Hollywood for all the same reasons that we hate Hollywood today. But there was at least this strain of action movies. Mostly, you know, the sort of macho men, Chuck Norris, Clint Eastwood, Schwarzenegger, who were basically all Republicans. I mean, certainly Schwarzenegger and Chuck Norris were, and Clint Eastwood. And so this served as sort of cathartic, I think, a cathartic service of, you know, maybe you couldn't express your views anywhere else, but you could go watch Charles Bronson killed the bad guys, and you sort of felt there was a release valve from that experience. So why isn't Hollywood making those movies today? There are a few theories, but the one that I think is probably the most accurate is that we're now making movies for an international audience. And so we're not making movies that just scratch an itch of Americans. We're making movies are being made by foreign directors for foreign audiences. And the most obvious example of this is the remake of Red Dawn, which, you know, in the original Red Dawn is the Soviet Union basically invades a Colorado town. And in the remake, they were going to have China be the bad guy, but they can't do that because China, like, we want to sell them this movie. So they had to make it North Korea, which took a sort of absurd idea and made it even more absurd. And that's an obvious example of how, you know, why, you know, we talk all the time, you hear all the time people talking about the problem of these multinational corporations and how they're not, you know, they're sort of taking their tax money abroad and they're not loyal to America and all the implications of that. Well, I would say Hollywood is exporting a product very important, and the problems of them being multinational trickle down as well. And I think, you know, now these movies aren't as good. And I don't think conservatives are getting their itch scratched as much as they did in the 80s either.
Well, this seems to me like an opportunity for conservatives. It's an interesting dynamic that you're picking up on that Hollywood has to recalibrate to appeal to a global audience and not a national audience. But that should only be a damper on jingoistic movies. It shouldn't necessarily be a damper on conservative-themed movies, because in theory, conservative themes should have broader principles that go beyond borders. I mean, The Incredibles is a straight-up libertarian movie, which I'm sure did very well abroad because it's because the themes are pretty subtle. There's nothing American about it. And I don't see why this conservative shouldn't say, look, here's a chance to talk about freedom and markets and even religion. There's obviously, you know, plenty of chances to talk about cultural conservatism to other countries. They're certainly more culturally conservative than us. Means you're not going to necessarily have a Rambo-type movie anymore. But there's certainly plenty of things that conservatives could do in Hollywood that I think there are, I mean, Wedding Crashers, you know, Vince Vaughn is a big, you know, Ron Paulite, and he wove in lots of anti-environmentalist, anti-liberal hypocrisy themes in Wedding Crashers that I think liberals just, you know, completely ignored and lapped up the movie. I think we talked about this in a past show.
Did, yeah.
So,
added benefit, so lots of hot chicks in the movie too. So, you know, social conservatives may not appreciate the, you know, the sort of theme of the movie as much, but I think libertarians and fiscal conservatives, definitely something to like in it.
And did Passion of the Christ do extremely well globally?
I suspect it did, but I mean, again, that is a universal theme, not something that's scratching a sort of uniquely American itch. Like, for example, I would argue that that the Death Wish movies, the Charles Bronson Death Wish movies, were came about because of the obvious endemic street crime in New York City, and spoke to a very specific audience about things that were actually happening at the time. I think the Dirty Harry movies with Clint Eastwood really spoke to the sense that something was slipping away, that we were losing something that the center could not hold, and that, you know, liberalism had gone maybe a little bit too far, and that, you know, crime was rampant. You know, those movies were sort of uniquely American. And then I think that the Rambo and the Missing in Action movies and the Rambo movies really addressed the Vietnam syndrome. This sort of uniquely American situation where America had been embarrassed and needed to regain its swagger a little bit. And I think Reagan was instrumental in helping with that. And I think these movies kind of worked in tandem with Reagan of helping put the Vietnam era behind us a little bit, of dealing with it, a very cathartic thing. So it's not just that they're conservative. It's that they were dealing with uniquely American concerns, and I would argue that is it's therapeutic for Americans to deal with those things, because, you know, you could argue that these movies incite people with jingoism, or you could also argue that this is the release valve that Americans need to deal with these issues, and that they were doing it at the movie theater, essentially.
Well, yeah, it just seems to me that you can still do that. You just have to adapt to what is culturally relevant today. I mean, we don't have the same level of street crime or the same paranoia about street crime as we had before, but we have other things that we certainly are twitchy about. Yes, and conservatives just have to adapt. If you don't mind me segueing out of this topic, we just had this big Freedom Summit in New Hampshire that was sponsored by Americans for Prosperity, which is a Koch brothers operation, as well as Citizens United. A lot of the potential 2016ers on the Republican side trumped up there. And I wrote about this at the Campaign for America's Future site, our future.org, this week. Rand Paul gave a speech where he starts talking about how Republicans need to recalibrate, and saying, you know, he literally says, we can't be the party of the plutocrats. I mean, he's saying this at a Koch brothers event. We can't be the party of the plutocrats. We have to show our concern for the unemployed. He says there are more people in the workers class than the owners class. I mean, the guy's literally sounding like a Marxist. And then he goes on to say, here's how he said we have to show our concern. We have to show that that we have the ideas to address their concerns. He said we got to show that Obama's ideas, you know, he says Obama gives you free stuff, but you're still in poverty. And then he says, when was the last time America created millions of jobs? It was Ronald Reagan. Now, so this is what Rand Paul says. So he's literally stuck in the 80s. He is so stuck in the 80s, he ignores the 90s when Bill Clinton created more jobs than Reagan did. And his Reagan point was to say, what did Reagan do? He talked forthrightly about cutting taxes for everybody. He didn't just do it for low-income people. He did it for everybody. He took the top rate down from 70% to 28%, and he created 20 million jobs. They've already created 16, but that's nitpicking. But obviously, Clinton created more than 20 million jobs, and he raised taxes on the top 1%. George Bush cut the top rate, and he had the worst jobs record in all of recorded history. So, it's not to discount what Reagan did, but obviously you can't hang it all on the top tax rate, because there's other evidence that counters that. That's pretty recent evidence.
Well, let me explain to you what happened, though. In the 1980s, Reagan succeeded despite a Democratic Congress. In the 1990s, Clinton succeeded because of a Republican Congress. Once you understand that, I think these problems will take care of themselves.
I mean, obviously, Republicans like to say, "Well, we cut spending," and clearly, Clinton cut spending. But spending wasn't even Paul's point. Paul made a specific tax argument. He credited Reagan's jobs just on cutting the top tax rate. And it's not to say that there's no argument for cutting top tax rates in certain circumstances. There are more complicated arguments one could make, but it's not what Rand Paul made. He made a very simplistic argument that is easily rebutted. And because he is so enamored with the 80s, he left himself vulnerable for those attacks. And no one's you're going to say it's 3 years out. Nobody cares. Yeah. But if this guy was the nominee, if this was the first presidential debate, you cannot get away with that. You would get destroyed. And if I'm a conservative, I got to say to myself, look, I may lap it up. I may say, well, I get what he's saying, and I can make a more sophisticated argument defending Reagan, blah, blah, blah. But you got to choose a nominee, and you got to ask yourself, am I going to choose someone who's really just not ready for primetime at all? Because he makes sloppy arguments like that all the time.
Well, he's also been on both sides. He's gotten away very deftly at being on both sides of a lot of issues, including immigration. If he is enamored with the 80s, I do wonder if he knows who the Fall Guy is. Bill, I hate to do a diversion here, but I've noticed another problematic trend with my colleagues, and that is that they listen to blogging heads. I've got my door shut, but I project. And so last week when I walked out, they said, "Who were you yelling at?" this week, I have elicited tweets from one of my colleagues, a guy named Will Ron, who has fired off a series of tweets. I'll read a couple. Apparently, Matt Lewis is on Blogging Heads right now complaining about how his younger coworkers don't get, quote, cultural references. Another tweet, like, excuse me. Here's Matt K. Lewis being a bitter old man because we don't share his deep knowledge of awful 80s TV. I guess Matt K. Lewis didn't get laid in the 80s, and now we all have to pay for it. So then John Podhoretz tries to come to my defense, and Will Ron tweets, "Screw you, old man." So, J. Pod just responded, "In my day, you would have been put in the stocks for such impertinence." So I have touched off a generational confrontation here on Twitter based on a show that has not even aired yet that we are now taping. It's a good thing I check Twitter when you talk.
But to my deeper point.
Whatever, Bill. Let's just make it about me.
maybe Rand Paul can save himself with cultural 80s references, but perhaps he needs a little bit more if he wants to go the distance. And there's a bunch of Republicans this week hammering Rand Paul. Brett Stevens at the Wall Street Journal, Wall Street Journal columnist, just wrote a column saying, "Rand Paul for president if you want to suffer the biggest landslide in American history." Admonishing conservatives to be a little bit more hard-headed. Jennifer Rubin slammed Paul for giving a mealy-mouthed answer on foreign policy. I think it was about Iran, if I remember correctly, saying he's gonna pay for this interview if he becomes the nominee later because he's opened himself up to sounding like an appeaser. So there's definitely the establishment folks are getting worried that Rand Paul's getting traction, which I imagine is a dynamic that is predictable, although I wouldn't necessarily predict this early in the process. But certainly, I think you and I have said this before, if he gets close to the nominee, certainly the establishment is going to try to close ranks and shut him down. But if I was sympathetic to Rand Paul, I would still be worried that maybe he's not the best flag bearer for my views if he's going to lead with his chin, say things that are patently false, and embarrass my preferred ideology. I mean, do you think any conservatives are second-guessing Paul because he does stuff like this all the time?
All right, so it's time for me to go on another rant, a different rant, which is to say...
Close the door!
I'll preface it by saying I just finished reading an old book by Michael Lewis, originally called Losers, but I think they retitled it Trail Magic or Trail Mix or something.
Trail Fever. I think it was Trail Fever first, and then it was Losers.
Okay, well, Losers is the best.
I have the hardcover Trail Fever copy. It actually is a fantastic
book. It is a good book. It's really funny. Actually, it's fun. Having read it, I now wonder if Dave Weigel isn't, doesn't secretly worship that book. It sounds a lot. It's fun. It's written funny, and it reminds me of him a little bit. So really good book. And so I respect and admire, people who cover campaigns and who go on the trail with the candidates. And I especially liked how he was very funny and cynical about the whole thing. And so it's with that in mind that I'm finding myself having covered a few presidential races and been, sentient. I've been watching many, many throughout my lifetime now. The common theme of this show apparently is me aging. Having watched multiple presidential elections, I'm becoming very fed up with the sort of breathless reporting and tweeting of journalists who, you know, 2 or 3 years out are going to New Hampshire and reporting on something that Mike Huckabee says, a joke that he makes about America being less free than North Korea or something. It's sort of reporting on it as if it matters, as if it's news, and hang on the every word of a guy who may not even run for president just because he goes to a state, you know, 3 years before an election or something. And I've discovered my tolerance for such things is very low. Certainly there are things that can be derived from going on the trail, and there can be really good reporting. I mean, Michael Lewis reported on things, you know, that losers like the Grizz and Pat Buchanan and Phil Graham said and did. But he did it in a sort of, cynical, funny, self-aware way. And I get this, you know, just these reporters who are ginning up things now as if they matter so far out in the cycle, starting to get under my crawl a little bit, Bill. Is this me? Is this grumpy old me? Or is this, am I onto something here?
Oh, I mean, there are people who watch us who regularly complain that we're talking about 2016 all the time. I think it's a standard complaint that political journalists cover this stuff too far out, which one I disagree with. I would not like to live in a country that had snap elections and 2 month campaign cycles, and rush it. Quite frankly, I think you make worse decisions that way. I think it is beneficial to American democracy that we have long vetting periods. I think we weed out a lot of chumps, doing it this way. If I was a Republican in 2012, you might have had, you know, nominee Michelle Bachmann if you had a snap election and only one debate.
Right. You might have.
So the length of the process doesn't bother me. But where I'm sympathetic to you is I think because it's long, because there is there's much more of a pressure now for clickable articles and breathlessness, that little things get overhyped all the time. And, you know, just for example, I was on Twitter. I was on Twitter last two nights ago. Twitter was going nuts over this Michael Bloomberg interview, where he says that he's not going to get interviewed when he goes to heaven. He's going to go straight in. And then the reporter then said, it was the most mind-blowing interview I've ever had. I have more quotes that I couldn't even include, and I'm going to have more tomorrow. And then he posts the ones tomorrow, and they're pretty mundane quotes. So even the first quote, like, you know, it's a little haughty, but, you know, I've seen worse in my day. And certainly not even the most relevant thing from the article about his funding of anti-gun campaigns in swing states. Last night, everyone on my Twitter feed was going nuts about the Obama-Biden selfies. This was the most humiliating, embarrassing thing for a president and vice president to do. Whereas I imagine a lot of people the next day think it's a pretty cute photo and go about their day. You know, everyone just has this overreaction to a lot of little stuff, which I imagine feeds into the notion, why should we have these three-year campaign cycles that aren't about anything? That, I agree, is not the best use of this extra time. But right.
And that's my point. That's my point, Bill. I actually don't mind speculation that is, you know, for example, I wrote a thing about, you know, a year ago or many, many months ago about how it's going to be. And at the time, this was kind of a novel idea. It's become conventional wisdom since then. But about how they're really fighting for, there's like a Tea Party primary where Rand Paul and Ted Cruz are fighting for that division. And there's a more establishment primary where at the time I said it was Rubio and Christie, maybe now it's Jeb Bush, we're fighting for that turf. Like, to me, that's fine speculation. Of course, I'm going to say it's fine. I wrote it. But that's different. That's different than going to New Hampshire this far out and making a big deal out of something that Mike Huckabee says and trying to generate like attention and buzz out of something that Mike Huckabee, who toyed with everybody 4 years ago and may in fact do it again this time, who knows, says, and trying to you know, somehow divine or you know, I don't know, inflate that into being somehow a telling part of the campaign. Now, maybe if you wrote that down in your notebook, in your diary, and looking back, writing a book about the campaign, maybe that will prove to be a consequential thing that Huckabee said. But that's not what's happening. It's the immediacy. It's the granular thing. And I think it's over, you know.
I mean, people tend to make, journalists, political journalists tend to make excessively definitive pronouncements out of small incidents, and I agree with you, that's a problem. But I do think, particularly on the Republican side, there is this broader soul-searching that's still going on about the direction of the party. And here's Rand Paul making a case how he would do things differently, how he would expand the tent, and he would attract people who are not traditional Republicans. You know, part of the argument was this whole civil liberties thing. He got into that too. And this other part was this anti-plutocrat thing. We should be against corporate welfare, but we should be for cutting taxes for the wealthy because it creates jobs. And so I think it's relevant to say, wait a second, you're making this case about how Republicans can be viable in the future, and it suffers from a glaring factual flaw. That to me is, I mean, what that means as far as, you know, does Rand Paul become the nominee, maybe is not the most important part of that discussion. But the broad discussion, how should Republicans present themselves and what issues they should stand on, how they should characterize it, that to me is an ongoing subject that's worth talking about.
Yeah, yeah. And if you like this kind of talk, then very good, because you're going to get a couple more years of it. And if you don't, then too bad, because you're going to get a couple more years of this sort of talk. So just, you know.
Well, separate from my whole point about his Reagan argument, what about Rand Paul saying we can't be the party of the plutocrats? Is that a message that you think Republicans are going to eat up, or are there too many Republicans that are too sympathetic to the owners class who'd say, wait a second, maybe let's not be haters here? I mean, and Rand Paul tried to try to smooth it out because he tries to play both sides. Yeah, I have nothing against the owners class. You know, I'm still for cutting their taxes, but yada yada yada. Does he take the argument too far, and will that be unsettling for Republicans who are trying to give him a serious look?
I think that it's good rhetoric. And I don't think anybody cares unless you start actually hurting the fat cats. I think that there is a, first of all, as you know, philosophically, I think there is a very good conservative argument that big business is not the same as free markets, and that big business likes regulations that only they can comply with. I also think from a political standpoint, conservatism has worked well when there's at least a populist strain to it, as opposed to the country club thing that the Bushes had. I think Reagan certainly, the Reagan Democrat thing, that Reagan certainly tapped into that. And I mean, the Pauls are sort of like the insider's outsider or the outsider's insider. I mean, they're a dynasty now, and Rand Paul is part of the most exclusive club in America, the U.S. Senate. But unlike the Bushes, I think they're still outsiders. And even though Rand Paul grew up the son of a congressman, one does get the sense that that it was still an outsider's thing happening, in Texas, and that they were more or less regular folks to some degree or another. And so I do think that Rand is onto something if he can sort of take his brand of conservatism and tie it a little bit to a more populist message. I think there's an audience for that, and I think Mike Huckabee tapped into that, and Rick Santorum every once in a while taps into that a little bit too.
Now, another 2016 possibility, a dark horse, if you will, that got thrust into the spotlight this week is Susana Martinez, who is the Republican governor in New Mexico, hasn't gone to Iowa, hasn't gone to New Hampshire, isn't getting the level of attention that Cruz and Paul and Christie and Jeb Bush have gotten. But still a bit of a sleeper, certainly checks off a lot of demographic boxes, a woman, Latina, geographic Southwest, far from the Beltway. Mother
also
Jones.
Mexican-American, not Cuban-American, which I think is significant electorally, from a family of Democrats, which like Reagan, maybe help appeal to people who have traditionally been from a Democratic family background. And she shoots guns too, so that's always helpful.
Now she gets ambushed by a Mother Jones investigative piece that is hinged upon private audio that they obtained from her internal 2010 campaign discussions with her closest staff, and I believe emails as well, but they have the audio clips on the site, and a lot of attention is being put upon the salty language she uses about her opponent. She calls a female opponent that little bitch, for example. I think someone else is called a tool. She's of course trying to make eggnog out of cracked eggs by fundraising off it, saying, let's stand up against the evil liberal media. But presumably somebody very close to her just stabbed her in the back and handed these audio tapes over to Mother Jones. So I don't know if you have any sense of what intra-party battles are going on in New Mexico that someone would be compelled to do that. What's your take about all this? Does it raise her stock? Does it hurt her stock? Is there something underlying there that she should be worried about? What's your overall take?
Well, first of all, I think you're absolutely right. It's very concerning when some it's seemingly somebody very close to you has leaked this information to Mother Jones. So that is a huge problem, and I think it's concerning. I wrote something at the week about this as well, and I think, Bill, that it's the Palinization of Susana Martinez, though. I mean, you know, I think that clearly, you know, people thought Palin was going to be this existential threat because she was this woman who, governor of Alaska, had an 88% approval rating when she was picked by John McCain to be his running mate. And I do think there was a very systematic attempt to destroy her and discredit her. You and I think, agree, Bill, that she enabled this by the way that she responded to it. But I think the initial stimulus that she had to respond to was thrust upon her externally. And I think that you could argue that Susana Martinez, for the reasons we've just laid out, is a very dangerous threat to a party that has clearly hitched their wagons to the war on women narrative, and also to something which the Republicans have helped facilitate, which is this notion that Republicans are anti-Hispanic. I personally think that Hispanics are really the only, maybe the area of growth and the only hope that Republicans have going forward, and that they've essentially gone out of their way to destroy this. But that's another topic. So I do see this as a somewhat of a political hit. I don't know how it came about, but look, the Palin derangement syndrome was real, and you saw it in the Trig Trutherism, but you also saw it in the hacking of her emails. We have seen this trend of on the left of people, whether it's Mitch McConnell's private campaign staff meetings being taped by somebody outside the room, whether it's Sarah Palin's emails being hacked, whether it's Mitt Romney and a private off-the-record fundraising meeting having his comments taped by a bartender and leaked to Mother Jones. I mean, this is a trend that's happening. It seems to be happening with Republicans being the victims in most cases. And it's hard not to put it in that context. It's hard not to see this as, here we go again, another Republican rising star who is, in this case, I think, wisely stayed out of the media spotlight, not coming to things like CPAC, focusing on being a governor. I think she's got to be on the short list of running mates, of possible VP selections, if she doesn't run for president herself. And I do think that she is a danger to the left.
Well, to your point about the left trying to Palinize her, we should emphasize that the article itself, the Mother Jones article, made that connection. They said, is Susana Martinez the next Sarah Palin because she is vindictive and also ignorant about certain elements of government? They have some examples where she's asking questions about what does this agency do or what does this committee do. I thought that was that part of the article. I thought was unfair, and also like not strategically smart. You know, you may be correct that the left would like to Palinize her, but she has to act like Sarah Palin to be like Sarah Palin. You know, I mean, Sarah Palin responded to attacks upon her by becoming more and more of a caricature of a right-wing nut over time, to the point where, like, she has completely gone off the cliff. You know, if she responded to those attacks by rising above it and showing her grasp of public policy, then those attacks would not have stuck. You know,
I agree. I think one of the reasons to rile people is a sort of psychological warfare. That people, when riled, they will respond in sometimes very bad ways. And I agree with you, Bill, that Palin was mistreated and abused, I think, by the media and by the left. And I think that she then that radicalized her. And I think that she was on a very different trajectory as governor of Alaska, again, with an 88% approval rating, seen as a reformer. And I do think that the attacks sparked her to change and not, in my opinion, not necessarily for the better. And But that's strangling the baby in the crib. That's what they're trying to do, is see somebody that poses a threat and snuff them out before they can fully mature.
Right. I mean, and obviously, I think it is often in a political opponent's best interest to define you before you can define yourself. But you, when you do that, you got to hit the mark. And, you know, I think right now, you know, big numbers being done on Chris Christie, it's not really a first impression deal, but, you know, there's a real sense of, like, you have the goods on Christie with this Bridgegate thing, and Christie keeps doing things that are very blustery and bullyish that feed that narrative by himself. So I think, you know, you're onto something there. You know, if you're going to try to knock a politician because she calls an opponent a bad name in private, I mean, come on. Every politician or campaign aide does that. That's just blowing off steam in private. That's not examples of, like, real bully tactics. So I if you're going to try to pin down her, that's very easy for her to slip out of. If you're going to say she doesn't know about government functions, I mean, all she was doing in those examples there was asking questions. Like, there's no politician that knows everything. Good politicians admit when they don't know something and ask questions to people who do know and get smarter. That was pretty standard run-of-the-mill stuff that was in those emails that were uncovered. If she then goes out and says completely idiotic things about government, then she has a problem. She can solve that problem by not saying dumb things about the inner workings of government, and that won't fly. You know, the one thing in those audio tapes that I thought actually was a problem for her was when she said privately, you know, I think we should be cutting teacher salaries, but I know we can't say that on the campaign trail. That was more, you know, revealing of being outright dishonest. I don't necessarily think it's fatal, because people are cynical enough, I think, to allow that stuff to go to be overlooked, depending on what other action she takes. But for the most part, lots of us kind of cheap shots that I think it'd be very easy for her to not be handcuffed by a manufactured narrative. You know, we've seen Republicans try to create a narrative of Obama that he's actually dumb because he said 57 states once, not 50 states. He used the teleprompter. He can't speak off the cuff. You know, these are all things that are easily overcome by not being stupid and doing town halls that show you don't use a teleprompter. So I don't think Materials is in a problem of being put in a Palin box just because one article tries to put her in that box. She has choices she can make to avoid that problem.
Well, I mean, what the left tries to do to Republicans is you're either evil or stupid. You know, you fit into one of those two boxes if they can caricature you. I mean, I guess the lesson to learn from this is, especially if you're a Republican, there is no privacy. There is no, not even like, lawyer confidentiality. I mean, you should always assume that everything you say is being taped.
I mean, when I was in college, you know, I took a 200 level college course where the professor was warning us what, you know, life in real Washington is going to be like. And he told us back then, always assume there's a camera in the room, because you never know. I mean, this is before YouTube. This is before the internet, where he was telling us this. And it should be even more obvious today. But you should be able, I mean, look, there's all things that we say privately, to cut to the chase, and that you wouldn't say publicly. I know it's a little hard to get around that, but you should be able to do your business without saying things that would get you in trouble.
Oh, I totally agree. I totally agree. But just imagine if we had the Lyndon Johnson, you know. I mean, I know we have some tapes of him recorded at the White House, but the trove of Lyndon Johnson campaign meetings or something. I mean, right. Or, you know, I mean, or even Bill Clinton, you know, just the stuff that we would learn. I mean, there is something lost when you have to fear that every private utterance is going to be revealed. But I guess it's the world in which we live.
Well, but it can also sharpen your focus. You know, you might if you got to think two seconds before you blurt something out that's offensive, maybe that's going to make you think, maybe I don't really mean that. Maybe that's not an important point to make. Maybe I can talk about my views on teachers that just speak to what I think is politically possible and what I'm willing to talk publicly about and not say the other thing.
I agree. You know, Bill, when I started doing TV a lot, they always say practice like you play. You know, if you're playing baseball, you shouldn't develop bad habits in practice, that because under pressure you will execute what you've practiced. And the whole point of practice is to work the muscle memory so that under times of stress and crisis you will react as you have sort of trained yourself subliminal or subconsciously to react. And so I've tried to not say anything that I wouldn't say on TV at all. And I think that might be a really good habit. And by the way, I break the rules, of course. But that might be a really good habit for people who are politicians and held to much higher standards than people who just opine on politics.
I think the way this could go is, as more and more of these things get leaked out, there's a law of diminishing marginal utility here. You know, Susana Martinez called her opponent a bitch. You hear five more politicians say things like that, you're going to say, that's what politicians do. I don't care. It doesn't affect me. It doesn't mean she can't work across the aisle. If she still passed these five bills with Democratic votes, she's not the most vindictive person on the planet. People blow off Steve in private, whatever. I think you might get a degree of that too, where it's really got to cross a high threshold for it to really, you know, knock you out of your stupor and say, well, that really is an inappropriate thing for a politician to do. We don't look at our politicians like heroes and icons much anymore. They are more just like us because of the way that we have the media these days. And you're going to see politicians do more average everyday things. And that's probably okay.
And it's funny because I think this, you know, on one hand, there's a traditional conservative vibe that would say that's a bad thing, that we should have heroes and revere our leaders. And then I think there's a more libertarian conservative strain that would say, well, this is good. We shouldn't be idolizing and romanticizing our politicians because that leads us to become dupes and to be serfs. And so I think it cuts both ways.
We should end on that jointly agreed upon DMZ note.
Almost made it through the show without my light going off. It goes off after an hour, I think. So that means that we've been talking for almost an hour. I started during our pre-interview discussion. So, yeah, I'd say it's probably time to wrap it up.
All right.
I was sitting there in the dark.
I'm not sure I can be here next week, so I'm going to be on a little mini vacation. So we should talk about who should take my slot.
Well, whoever it is, I don't want a millennial because nothing good's going to come from that. But we'll have your people talk to my.
It could be educational. You could teach the millennial all the cultural references that he or she should know to survive
in
society.
That's the problem with them. They have no interest in learning. They don't know what they don't know. We should also consider. Remember last year we had my smoking hot wife came on and Mother's Day. And talked about such things, and we could talk about doing that again.
Absolutely. I'm sure my smoking hot wife has absolutely no interest in doing this show ever.
And by the way,
I'm happy to talk to your wife.
The smoking hot wife thing is a 2000s reference, I think, from The Anchorman. Not The Anchorman, from Talladega Nights. Hmm. So my references do not end in 1989. They go all the way up until like 2004. So
they tend to end once you have babies.
You know what's funny? Mine is the opposite. In all honesty, my knowledge of pop culture essentially ended in 1998 when I started doing, you know, like working my adult life basically. And they started up again when I had kids and started watching TV again. So the kids have revitalized my it doesn't mean that I go out to see movies a lot, because that's the hard part, but you know, the Breaking Bads, the all that good stuff. So
you might have noticed when I wrote my last piece for your publication, The Daily Caller, I dropped in a Daniel Tiger reference. I don't know if anyone was impressed by that, but I was proud of myself.
So anyway, we don't know when we're going to be back or if the show will be renewed for a fifth and final season, but we will keep you alert, and I suspect somebody will be back here in the DMZ next week.
Yes, sir. We'll see you then.
All right, man.